Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Anirudh Kanisetti. Today I have with me Dr. Shambhavi Naik and Sardak Pradhan. And we're going to be talking about a very, very controversial article that Shambhavi has recently written that has gotten a lot of uncles and aunties very, very mad at us indeed. And this article basically argued that it's about time that Indians stop marrying within their caste. So what we're going to be doing in this podcast is basically unpacking the various reasons why Shambhavi made this argument and adding a little bit of additional context. So we're obviously going to be talking about the historical and the political economy and the religious aspects of it, but we'll also be getting into the most important reason for why we should not be continuing with the system, aside from the fact that it perpetuates systems of injustice and so on and so forth, which is a public health based argument. All right, so without any further ado, let's get started. Shambhavi, can you tell us what exactly you said that got so many people so concerned about our marriage culture?
Right, and what I found very interesting is this is not the first time I'm saying this, right, that you should marry outside your caste. However, this particular piece in the print has got a lot of attention. What I'm basically arguing for is that there have been these age-long traditions of, you know, when you're getting married, and especially if you're going to get married through the arranged marriage route, then you try to find someone in your own caste. It's usually the elders in the family that try and look up for a match for you. And the reason why I wrote this piece now is actually because two of my cousins are of and a marriageable age. And I've been part of a lot of these family discussions on how they should marry within the caste. And I have been upfront and saying that, no, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And so the obvious discussions are around, oh, is a boy from our caste and what Gotra is he from, right? Mm-hmm. And after all of that, we'll look at the Patrika and then we will consider whether we should go meet the guy or not.
So that how is, scientific, I just have to say.
So this is where the piece actually stemmed from. And I was trying to kind of distill all my thoughts that I've got from having multiple discussions with a lot of elders in the family and trying to persuade them that this is not a good idea. So what I argue is that, look, I understand why you would think caste marriages work, because you would like to get your daughters married off in a family which has similar traditions like yours, who speak a similar language like yours. And that I understand. But we have been practicing endogamy for such a long time that we do see that certain castes have predispositions for certain diseases. And so perhaps for the future now, it makes sense that we have more intercaste marriages than trying to stick to traditions. Also, maybe decades ago, it made sense. You know, you did not have cars, you might not have phones, so you would probably like to get your child married off in an atmosphere that is very similar to home, or someone that you know very well, and therefore having caste marriages might have made sense. Now it really doesn't.
Okay, so I think at this point I'd like to bring Sardak in, because Sardak, you've studied caste and the reason why people tend to maintain caste endogamy marriages. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Anirudh, I feel one of the most fundamental features of Indian society is the principle of pollution and purity. And this is something which exists amongst us. It has been there for a very long period of time. And we don't even realize that it's there. It's so pervasive.
Yeah. And it's caste, so normalized.
Yeah, it's normalized. Okay. So caste system also, somewhere you will find the roots of all the features of the caste system over here. So according to this pollution purity principle, certain activities are considered to be purer, some things are considered to be polluted.
Like eating vegetarian food.
Yeah, vegetarian food or non-vegetarian food will be considered to be impure. Or some occupations might be considered to be pure, some occupations might be considered to be polluted. Also, at the same time, some people will be higher up the ritual hierarchy.
Yeah.
They will be purer as compared to others. Some people will be impure throughout. So I feel caste system is a mechanism by which you are preserving the purity levels. As in caste system as well as endogamy. When you are marrying within the same caste, you're ensuring that the pollution or the purity levels, they are remaining intact. So this has been there for a long period of time, and multiple sociologists, anthropologists have pointed this out. The most prominent being Louis Domo, who talks about it in Homo Hierarchicus. it is not that intercaste marriages didn't happen. They happened, but again, very few intercaste marriages used to happen in the past. Sometimes it might so happen that the man is from the higher caste and the female is from the lower caste.
Hmm.
In that scenario, intercaste marriages used to be allowed. Again, the reason being, you have a patrilocal setup. So after marriage, most likely the female is going to the husband's place and she is going to get the new caste of the husband that is going to happen.
Hmm.
And again, generally what used to happen was whenever these hypergamous bonds will be there, most likely exchange of dowry will be very high.
Yeah.
Because the female is trading, she's getting a new higher caste. In return, she has to pay something for it. But the hypogamous bonds, in which the female is from the higher caste and the man is from the lower caste, generally it will be rare. And now also you'll find that most of the honor killings are for these kind of scenarios.
And it's of course the lower caste man who is usually at the receiving end of the violence from the upper caste. So I want to kind of buttress this with a little bit of historical context. So it's very interesting that you brought up the idea that it's fundamentally about maintaining ritual purity, because I don't think a lot of people understand the rather curious ways in which medieval Indian society operated. Even like Al-Biruni, for example, when he visited India in the early 11th century, actually remarked with admiration about how Indians stuck to their professions and only married within their professions. We have to keep in mind that this is part of, at least theoretically, a highly rigid, highly ordered society where every single social group occupies a very particular part of the social hierarchy. And while in practice there might have been considerable variations, if you look at a lot of Sanskrit literature, for example, the picture they paint of cities is of very, very dynamic places where a caste and class and gender are basically interlocked in very, very complex ways and are constantly shifting. So we don't really know the extent to which this might have been pervasive, but what we can say without a doubt is that as time progressed, as the idea that this is how society should be ordered, as Indian states became more and more powerful, we do see more and more instances, instances of violence being perpetrated against the lower caste when they kind of subvert this order. And the reason why it worked for so long, of course, was the fact that so many other social groups are willing to adhere to a lower position in the system as long as they're higher than a few others. You pointed out how there's always some people who are considered to be impure, no matter what they do. And if you think about it, the purity of the entire society is built on stripping one particular group of theirs. And thus stripping them of their right to participate in rituals which reinforce their position within the social hierarchy. If you look at temples, for example, there's usually, at least up till very recently, there were only a few designated days on which Dalits would be allowed into the temple. And they'd be forced to worship the god in very particular ways that once again reinforced their low position within ritual hierarchy. So they would have to, present leather sandals to the god, which is very often seen as, oh, look how open-minded these people are by providing a position to them. But come on, it's nonsense. And it's really complicated, right? So I come from a caste called the Gavaras. So we are supposedly descended from merchants from Gowda, Bengal, who moved into Karnataka and Andhra Pradesh in the 11th and 12th centuries. This was when, you know, economic networks were really spreading across the hinterland of India. So there were clearly a lot of business opportunities. But as, you know, merchants, not necessarily very high in the caste system. And then I came across this fascinating inscription from, I think, 13th century Mysore, where a bunch of guys called something Seti and some other Seti, who sell the finest ornaments and pearls and horses and musks from across the seas, have restored a temple of Shiva and basically reconsecrated as Shiva Gavareshwara, the god of the Gavaras. So you can see that now, because their economic status has improved, they are now entering a higher position within the caste system. And you can imagine that there would have been so many other social groups like this who are slowly being integrated into the circles of the pure and the elevated and the high-minded, and thus taking part in this much, much broader system that reinforces certain kinds of social behaviors, a certain kind of caste hierarchy. But of course, it was deeply unequal, as you can imagine. One of the most fascinating incidents to me in medieval Indian history, which oddly enough is fairly well known in Karnataka, but not well known beyond that, was again, sometime I think in the 11th or 12th century, there was a bunch of revolutionary Shaiva poets, the Veera Shaivas, who got together in the great city of Kalyana. Now, Kalyana was one of the most dominant cities of the Deccan, like really immortalized in poetry, supposed to have been fabulously wealthy with, you know, merchants who were like literally had entire streets where just merchants who sold gold jewelry lived, and a whole street where merchants who sold perfumes lived, and that kind of thing. But also seems to have been very unequal, very, very rigid in terms of caste. Now, the Veera Shaivas actually congregate there. There's a kind of hall where they're all sitting and debating and creating these devotional songs, which are obviously set to like very ancient folk tunes. And they're literally taking the case of patriarchy and casteism. And they, I mean, they since they have some degree of support from within the institutions itself. So Basavanna was a minister of the king of Kalyana, was one of the Veera Shaivas. So there was some degree of, you know, institutional support for what they were doing. But one fine day, they married a Brahmin girl to a Dalit man. And that kicked off this whole cycle that ended with possibly the king being murdered by the Veera Shaivas, the city supposedly being set aflame, and the Veera Shaivas being thrown out of the city and spreading all over the Deccan and kicking off this wave of bhakti across this whole region, which is fascinating. It really, really makes you think how deep a lot of these social issues goes. But I've kind of gone on a tangent, as I tend to do. So let's kind of bring this back to the present day, right? There are a lot of arguments that are advanced in favor of continuing with caste-based marriages. The one that I saw uncles and aunties repeating most on your article, Shambhavi, was the fact that Gotras are supposed to be able to manage this. Gotras are supposed to maintain genetic diversity. So what are your thoughts on the matter?
This was also an argument that my old elders gave me, that, oh, but we are marrying outside the Gotra, so everything is fine. Hmm. My counter-argument to that is that, look, when you get a girl married off, supposedly her Gotra also changes. So she takes up the husband's gotra. Her genes are not changing. Okay, it's a simple scientific fact. Her genes are not changing.
Yeah.
And if you look at, particularly for marriages within the family, which is also quite a prevalent practice, where you get the girl married off to the aunt's son. In a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah. Or even like to the elder. So there's, for example, the aunt's son, I think, marrying your uncle, basically. Marrying the mother's youngest brother is...
Cross-cousin marriages are there in some parts of India. Southern part of India, you have cross-cousin marriages. Yeah. And among some religious communities, like among Muslims, parallel cousin marriages can also be there. Mm. But again, for that, there are different other reasons. And see, these kind of things you will not find prevalent in northern part of India. Southern part of India is there.
Mm.
So again, the reasons are different. For what could be the reason? Can anyone hear?
So Dravidian kinship is reckoned in a slightly different way. So Thomas Trotman, I think, has a book about this called Dravidian Kinship, where he talks essentially about this. So it's to do with much, much older traditions in terms of the way that inheritance is reckoned and so on and so forth. And more generally, just the way that family itself is thought of. So in South India, you will very often see people from a very wide variety of social groups describing themselves by who their maternal uncle is.
Okay.
The maternal uncle could be the person that would take you into his workshop, for example, if you're a sculptor, that would train you and all that. So you will see inscriptions from medieval Karnataka which say, for example, that I am XYZ, I am the son of ABC and the nephew of such and such. If you think about it, it's of course the mother is not mentioned because mother is clearly not a part of the identity of these people.
She had nothing to do with
any of this.
See, Iravati Karve, she tries to make a distinction between the kinship patterns that are there in the north and the south.
Hmm.
What she says is, in the south, agriculture is developing first. So again, the focus is on land, preserving land. And secondly, the northern part of India, that was the place where invaders used to come. So you are trying to maintain an extensive kinship patterns. So you have...
That is the argument even I have heard, that maintaining agriculture, lands...
And extensive kinship patterns.
Yeah,
because in northern part of India, you have Gotra exogamy. At the same time, many places you will also have village exogamy. And this can be for multiple generations. 5 generations, 7 generations.
So people have to marry outside their Gotra.
But within caste.
within that caste.
Within caste. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they marry outside not only their own gotra, their mother's gotra, their grandmother's gotra, and this can go on till 5 to 7 generations, depends on the places. And you're not supposed to marry within the villages. But this is something which is not prevalent in southern part of India, where the focus is on, again, preserving all the land.
I'll have to think about that, because I don't know if the archaeological data really supports the idea that agriculture originated in, like, earlier in southern India. But yes, what
I don't
saying,
know about that, but I've heard the argument that
This is by Irawati Karve, one of the most
that preserving agricultural land within the family was the underlying reason why a lot of people prefer to marry.
But anyways,
one of the things about the gotra thing is that if you're still marrying within your aunts or within your sisters, I think after she's married, then still family, you're still sharing genes, and so you're still kind of inbreeding for that matter. Even so, outside of the gotra, but within the caste, particularly if your caste is of very made up of very small numbers of people, then you have come down from a very few founder population. And so any genes that were mutated in them will stay accumulated within your caste. So unless there is an influx of genes, fresh genes coming from outside the caste, you will keep on carrying those diseases and you'll see them accumulating. So there are two different phenomena here. One is the idea that founder mutations, so mutations which are found in the people who started the caste, stay within the caste if there's endogamy. And two, if there are consanguineous marriages, so within the family, that also can cause fresh mutations. And that exacerbates the phenomena of genetic mutations that arises in the caste system. Just to clarify, this is not only particularly true of Hindu castes.
Of course not. I mean, I think one of the most pervasive myths about Indian society is that only it's just one religion that does this. Yeah. But the point that I made about it's fundamentally about social structuring. It's about a particular social positioning. I think applies to any religious group in India. Yeah. It's just the way that Indian societies generally operate. So, for example, I've seen there seems to be a pretty strong undercurrent in some sections of Twitter that deny that caste exists in Islam because it's not in the scriptures. Of course, it's not in the scriptures, man. The scriptures weren't written in India. But if you actually look at lived practice, there are also a fair number of Muslims who agree to this. But for some reason, their voices are never really considered when people are making these enormous stereotypings. Yes.
Caste might not be used. But again, there might not be marriages within, again, different sections among Muslims. The same applies for Christians as well. Again, among them also, you will find divisions.
And it's very important to remember that just the way that people might have converted to Islam or became Muslim in the first place. It's a complicated history. It's not very simple. You have instances of mass conversion of people who were originally living pastoral lives or on the border of settled agriculture, who converted to agriculture, began to speak new languages and also convert to Islam at the same time. This accepting accepting a particular part in the social hierarchy that I was referring to earlier. But on the other hand, you have Muslims who, just like some upper caste Hindus do, would claim descent from a great hero and so on and so forth to maintain a particular position in the social hierarchy. And keep in mind that this kind of categorization of Hindu and Muslim as being identities that don't talk to each other, I think is kind of a new idea in the way that Indian society is organized. I think if you were to look at an early modern Indian city, for example, you would see upper caste Hindus, upper caste Muslims basically occupying the same kind of social and economic niches. As such, there would be a need for them to be signaling their purity to each other. Especially because we know, if you look at the Mughals, for example, that there were intermarriages with upper caste Hindu families. So it's very, very complicated. It's a much more diverse system than we generally give it credit for, which is one of the reasons why it's so pervasive and why it seems so difficult to kind of unwrangle a lot of those myths today.
But I think what's really important for us now is to just accept that this is what has happened.
Yes.
And move on from here. Someone who has done this really well is the Ashkenazi Jew population. And we have spoken about it multiple times here at Takshashila, is this organization of Dor Yeshwaram, who recognize that there is a problem, that because of inbreeding, there are certain diseases which are more prevalent in their community. And they're actively taking steps to counsel young couples who might carry genes, the defective genes for the diseases, to not either marry with each other or take scientific help in having children who do not carry the disease. So there's nothing wrong with all of this currently. We just have to accept it. We cannot stay in the same traditions and say, no, this is what we have done and this is what we're going to always do. That's just stupid.
No, one thing that concerns me is how any critique of a practice that might have made sense given a very, very different social context, but that doesn't really make sense now given what we know, given the way that India operates now. Any criticism is perceived as a direct attack on one's faith. That's not really what anybody is trying to do. We're making an argument based on the national interest. We're saying that, look, it's in everybody's...
National interest, in your own interest.
It's in your own interest, man. Exactly.
If you don't care about the nation, it is for your own children.
And your grandchildren, most important. Don't forget about the grandchildren.
Here, one interesting study I found out. The study was by Indian Statistical Institute. So they find out that more intercaste marriages are likely to happen if the mother of the groom is educated.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Yeah. If you remember what I said earlier about how you basically have groups that are moving higher up the caste system, right? It's generally those groups that tend to be more performative of their ritual purity.
Yeah.
I think we still see that today where it's usually the upper caste families that tend to force their daughters to become housewives after getting them educated. That's just one aspect of the entire thing, right? So it's quite interesting that you bring that up because you would expect the educated mothers would not really buy into this. But I think that has to be seen at the intersection of upward mobility, both in economic and in social terms.
But one thing here, if the bride's mother is educated, that might not have major impacts. This also is something which the study finds out. Groom's mother, if she is more educated, chances are she will be the one who will be focusing on the interest of her son. But the same thing might not be applicable. That is what the study finds out. So again, interesting aspect. Women's education is important, but again, what is important is whether she is having a son or she is having a daughter. That can be an implication here.
Says a lot about the, and again, Doc, you pointed this out, right? The fact that DNA is considered to be something only men have, and then women's DNA changes after they get married.
The reason here being, as in women, female might be educated, but her say in her daughter's marriage might not be that important because the dishonor that comes majorly comes to the female whenever there is an intercaste marriage. So okay. son's marital status and the mother's impact on the son's marital status is more important because the dishonor part will be less for the son.
And it's so strange that people still pretend that it's about genetic diversity when honor is so explicitly brought into the whole discussion.
Yeah. I was so surprised by the Lokniti data because it showed about how urban populations were still practicing more within caste marriages and rural populations are, which is, yeah.
There have been some very interesting studies on just the way that caste operates in Bangalore, for example, where you will see actual colonies which are starkly divided on caste, where it's people from very particular upper caste. I will not mention the name, but I'm sure you can all guess.
I cite the study in my article, so you can
Look at the matrimonial websites or the English newspapers. Who reads English newspapers? Most likely people from urban areas.
Yeah.
And they're all segregated on the basis of caste.
Exactly.
Websites, who accesses websites? Those are on this side of the digital divide.
It's also very interesting to me how de facto new castes seem to be emerging. New ways of reckoning social hierarchy. So I'll give you an example. There's an armymatrimony.com. I've been told there's an IITIIMmatrimony.com.
There's one elitematrimony.com as well.
So I'm sure there's obviously a considerable overlap with existing caste systems. But it's also interesting to see how their identities are constantly being reshaped. The reason why caste has survived in India so long is because, as painful as it is for me to admit, it bloody works. In a society that's this diverse and this heterogeneous, it seems to be one way for social groups to stake claims to political and economic power. And none of that should be seen in isolation. It's what we're tackling is a very, very complicated problem. But that said, let us try to simplify it once again. So, Doc, final words.
So, if you're getting hitched, right, A, follow your heart, not your parents. B, if you're going to get married within your family, which you definitely should not, but if it's within your family or within your caste, what I would suggest is that there are certain companies which do offer genetic testing. for a certain number of diseases. Now, the science for how many diseases you can look at and how many diseases will definitely cause diseases, how many genetic mutations will definitely cause diseases, is a little shady. For example, for thalassemia, we know what the mutations are. Anyone and everyone should get themselves checked for thalassemia mutations.
Hmm.
Right? I have done mine. So the idea is that if you have a thalassemia defect, you might not even know about it. But if you marry somebody who also has a thalassemia defect, one in four of your children are likely to have a fully blown case of thalassemia. Right? And there are a few diseases like that which you could actually get tested for. So do that. Find out genetic compatibility from a disease point of view. If you do have a genetic incompatibility, then the decision is yours. Either you can go ahead and have kids or not have kids. If you're going to have kids, I would suggest you have what is known as PGD to screen for embryos which are healthy.
Hmm.
But that is like the extreme. And at this point of time, if you're going to get married, just make sure that you have genetic compatibility.
Okay, on that note, thank you so much, Doc. Thank you, Sadhak, for joining me. And thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.